It's October once again. The leaves are turning, the air is crisp. Occasionally you can smell the smoke of a wood fire in the distance. It's my favorite time of year. And it's especially my favorite time of year because every October my favorite group of people wearing black robes gets together. Yes, I'm talking about the United States Supreme Court. Their term begins and they just take on all sorts of important cases and consider all sorts of important issues. And it always gives me an excuse to talk to several of my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law who tell us about all these fascinating cases. And today we're going to hear about a criminal case involving a transvestite going to jail for 40 years. We're going to be hearing about labor disputes. We're going to hear about abortion. We're going to hear about air pollution. We're going to hear about all sorts of important things. So stick around and listen up. It's time for our annual Supreme Court Roundup.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
You know, there are a lot of myths about law professors. We're a bunch of stuffy old guys wearing tweed suits and frightening our students and speaking in long, boring sentences. And okay, well, I guess there's a lot of truth to that myth, but there are exceptions as well. Sometimes law professors are really nice people. Sometimes they have really interesting things to say. And I'm blessed because I teach at the Appalachian School of Law, and my colleagues, many of them, are very, very nice people who have very interesting things to say. And once a year, I ask several of them to come on the show and to talk to me about important cases that are currently pending before the current term of the United States Supreme Court. Now, not all of these cases that we're going to hear about here in a few minutes are, strictly speaking, constitutional. Some of them involve, for example, interpretations of federal regulations or federal statutes. But I can say without question that all of the cases we're going to talk about today are important and they're interesting. As you'll soon find out when I speak to Mary Ann Herman, who's going to tell us about an intriguing criminal case out of the state of Michigan. So, Mary Ann Herman, welcome to your weekly Constitutional.
Thanks, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now, I understand you're going to tell us about a criminal case here.
Yes. Today we're going to be talking about Burt versus Titlow, which
Burt
is...
Burt versus Titlow?
Yes.
Out of Michigan.
Out of Michigan.
Where both
out
you and I are from.
Exactly.
Well, it
Eastern
must be
District.
Important then.
Yes. Very important, very important.
Okay.
It discusses the Sixth Amendment and effective assistance of counsel, which is important.
Very important indeed. The Sixth Amendment guarantees our right to counsel, and if you don't have a good one, you might as well not have one at all. So what's the story here? What's the accusation?
Well, this comes to us from a homicide case from Michigan. In mm-hmm. this case, we have our defendant, Von Lee Nicole Titlow, who had helped his aunt, Billy Rogers, murder his wealthy uncle, Donald Rogers.
Hmm.
And what had happened in this case is that Billy found her husband, who was an alcoholic, passed out on the kitchen floor and began pouring vodka down his throat.
Mm.
Von Lee, our defendant here, then entered the picture and helped her out for a while, pouring vodka down his throat, but he soon stopped and walked away. And then our evidence suggests that Billy actually smothered Donald with a pillow, and that was how he died.
So aunt recruits nephew to help her kill uncle.
Right.
And then aunt, or the nephew starts to help, but then leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And then aunt apparently finishes off uncle with pillow.
Exactly.
Okay, that's supposedly what happened. Okay.
Right, and this was done because Billy, the aunt, stood to inherit the entire estate, which seemed to be fairly large.
Follow the money. Okay.
Right, so she inherited the estate, went on a spending spree, bought Titlow, Von Lee Titlow, a car, and cut him a check for $70,260.
Mm-hmm. What do you need all that money for?
Well, funny you ask, Stuart, because Von Lee Nicole Titlow is a transgender male, and he wished to have a gender reassignment surgery. He wants to become a woman.
Okay.
So he needed this money, and his aunt murdered his uncle, For several reasons, I suppose, but he did stand to profit from this.
Okay, so did he get his operation?
He did not get his operation. Before he was able to get the surgery, he was arrested.
Ouch.
And that's where our story starts.
Oh, it starts, okay.
It starts.
Uh-huh.
So, Titlow was charged with first-degree murder in Michigan courts.
Serious crime.
Serious crime. So prior to trial, he was offered a plea bargain, mm-hmm. where in exchange for his testimony in his aunt's trial, his conviction would be reduced to manslaughter, and he would be given a reduced sentence of 7 to 15 years.
That doesn't sound too bad.
No, sounds like a pretty good deal.
Did he take it?
Originally, yes, he did take it. His attorney explained the plea bargain to him, and that he could possibly be convicted of first-degree murder if he didn't take this.
Okay, so it sounds like a good deal. Okay, so what's the problem? Sounds pretty effective to me.
Right. He agreed to the plea. The court accepted it. There was no problem with that. He then had second thoughts.
Oh.
He hired a new attorney, who, by the way, he agreed to pay him with jewelry and the media rights to the case.
Mm.
And
This is a pretty titillating case. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Okay, the titlow case. All right, go on.
Right.
So the new lawyer comes on, and did they withdraw the plea?
They withdrew the plea. He hired this new attorney to withdraw the plea because Titlow maintained that he was, in fact, innocent.
I'm going to take a wild guess that didn't turn out too well. Did they go to trial?
They did go to
trial.
What
happened to Titlow?
They did go to trial, and he was convicted of second-degree murder.
Oh, man. That's still pretty serious.
To 20 to 40 years, which is significantly worse than 7 to 15.
So he's a transgender male who wants to become a woman who didn't quite get his surgery, stuck in the slammer for 20 to 40 years. I'm guessing it's a male facility.
It is. It is.
So that's even more difficult, perhaps, for such a person to be incarcerated.
Right,
in such a circumstance. Having second thoughts about that original plea.
Exactly. Very indecisive defendant here.
Okay.
He appealed, claiming that his second counsel, was ineffective for allowing him to withdraw the guilty plea and stand trial to mm-hmm. be subjected to this second-degree murder charge.
And what was the basis of saying he was ineffective? I mean, just because it didn't turn out well?
No, because he didn't obtain, the new attorney did not obtain the file or inspect the state's evidence, or even speak to the old attorney until after the plea withdrawal
hearing. Jeez Louise. So a lawyer goes in and withdraws an important plea agreement without having looked at the file?
Right.
Ouch. Okay, so there's your certainly malpractice issue, but I mean, he's talking ineffective assistance.
But is it ineffective assistance?
And the question, if I recall correctly, is that since this, whether to accept or reject a plea agreement is ultimately the client's decision,
Ultimately the client's decision.
So is that the issue, whether this is ineffective assistance or whether it was, was this the lawyer screwing up, or was mm-hmm. this simply the client making a bad decision that he's regretting?
Right, and that's always our question in ineffective assistance cases. And here, the Michigan Court of Appeals denied the claim, saying, no, this isn't ineffective assistance. This was just a bad decision on your part. And the Michigan Supreme Court didn't hear the claim. They refused to hear the claim. So he exhausted his
state
appeals.
So I bet he had to go habeas, didn't he?
He did. He then petitioned the federal district court for a writ of habeas corpus.
Right, and this is a collateral route. After you've exhausted your state remedies, you can go to the federal courts, ask them to look at the case again. So what happened? Did the federal court grant habeas relief?
Well, the district court denied habeas relief, mm-hmm. saying that Titlow did not establish that the Michigan Court of Appeals decision was contrary to federal law or an unreasonable determination of the facts.
Okay.
So
I'm guessing he then appealed that to the Sixth Circuit, right?
He appealed to the Sixth Circuit, who then granted relief.
Oh, so now he's winning.
Now he is
winning. Shouldn't the case have ended there then? He's happy? He's going to get his plea agreement reinstated?
Well, that is correct. The Sixth Circuit granted the habeas relief and ordered the state to reoffer the original plea, which is pretty
sweet deal, yeah.
Right? Based on the attorney's failure to obtain the original file.
Mm-hmm.
And also saying that Titlow, our defendant here, would have accepted the plea that he previously accepted. And they said that was enough to show that it was prejudice. Because not only do we have to show ineffective assistance of counsel, we have to show that our defendant was actually prejudiced by this.
Right, okay. So they believed him, that he would have accepted this plea if his counsel had advised him properly.
Exactly.
And so why are we in the Supreme Court? Who appealed it?
Well, our petitioner here, Bert, the state,
State of Michigan.
Warden.
The warden.
The warden.
What a sore loser. He wants this guy still in prison, so he got
the warden. The poor warden always gets sued in these habeas cases, but the warden petitions the Supreme Court, who granted cert.
So what is your prediction then? What do you think the United States Supreme Court's going to do to Titlow?
Well, I think that Titlow might be out of luck in this case.
You think so, huh?
I do. I think that...
The simple fact that the court granted cert in a circumstance where a guy's going to otherwise go free suggests that maybe they want to keep him in the slammer in this case.
Right, and I'm not sure that he would go free. There would still likely be some sentence.
Right. The fact they want to keep him in for the full time, or at least that's what it looks like. He must have been very disappointed when the Supreme Court agreed to hear this case.
Right. And I think the Supreme Court also saw this as an opportunity to clarify opinions from last year, especially when it comes to the resentencing on these plea agreements that were found to be ineffective.
Well, this is going to be a fascinating case, Marianne, and let's keep up with it, and then you can come back and tell us what happened to poor old Titlow.
Excellent. Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you, Marianne.
And now let's hear from Professor Doug McKechnie. Now, Doug's been on the show many times, and he's almost always talking about the First Amendment. Today, he's talking about free speech and abortion.
Well, Stuart, this year I have a very interesting case that is coming out of Massachusetts, and it's a case that I find interesting because it very well could result in overturning a previous Supreme Court case. So I always think that that's a very fascinating situation.
Yes, it is. What's the previous case that it might overturn?
Well, the previous case that it might overturn is a case called Hill versus Colorado. Mm-hmm. And in Hill versus Colorado, the Colorado legislature had passed a statute that that controlled whether or not people could and how they could protest in front of healthcare facilities.
Oh, and, abortion clinics.
Well, interestingly, I think the intent was to control how people protested in front of abortion facilities, but the statute itself actually was directed at healthcare facilities. So,
okay.
And theoretically, any healthcare facility.
Right.
But the reality was, I think.
So, if I want to go down and have a protest in front of my podiatrist's
that's
office,
right.
This would tell me what I should and should not
that's
do.
Right, that's
okay.
Right. But the reality, I think, is that it was directed at abortion clinics, and there were some problems with some of the protests and counseling in front of abortion clinics. And what the statute said was that within a 100-foot radius in front of the entrance to a healthcare facility, people were not allowed to, if there were protesters or others who wished to speak in front of a healthcare facility, within 100 feet of the healthcare facility, you couldn't approach others who were trying to enter the facility. You couldn't approach them within 8 feet of where they were. And so I know that's kind of hard spatially to...
First of all, we draw a 100-foot circle around the entrance.
That's right.
We say that if you want to be in there, okay, you can come in there and protest. But within that 100-foot radius, now there's another 8-foot radius around any person you have to approach.
That you may not approach, unless they...
You can't approach
them.
That's what I'm saying. You want to approach them, so you and I are within the 100-foot radius, and I want to go up and hand you something.
Can't do that.
I can kind of wave it at you,
mm-hmm.
but I cannot actually close enough to hand it to you.
Unless I approach you or tell you that you can come over, I give you some sort of consent to
okay.
approach me. Right. And so the idea is that they were trying to protect... they were really trying to protect the people who were accessing the facilities, and there were allegations of intimidation. The protesters alleged that they were really just trying to counsel these, mainly women, trying
sure.
to access abortion clinics. And
that's Hill versus Colorado.
That's Hill versus Colorado, and the Supreme Court said, I think somewhat surprisingly, that statute was a permissible regulation of what we call time, place, and manner. And so the place in which people can protest was limited, but it was limited because the Supreme Court found that it was content neutral, that it didn't matter.
Content neutral? Oh, okay. See, now I see why you wanted to, you were pained to explain this. It's clearly aimed at abortion. And yet they kind of bought into the fiction that this also controls protesting outside your dentist's office.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
right.
But also they said, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to counsel these people to not access the healthcare facility or to, in fact, access the healthcare facility.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what your purpose
okay,
is.
Okay, I see.
There was no reference to a specific content of speech or no reference to any particular kind of speech. And so whether you were in front of the healthcare facility to encourage people to access the healthcare facility or to discourage them.
And
it was
we all know that happens frequently, that you have protesters outside abortion clinics saying, yeah, go in and do it.
Go.
That doesn't okay.
No. And, you know, I guess you do in front of some healthcare facilities do have people who are trying to help usher people in and access them.
Okay, that is actually true. There are actually people who actually will go in and help. Escort them, I think they're called. So, okay, I guess it's a little more neutral than I was characterizing it. But again, we know the main reason they're doing this.
Right. And this, the Supreme Court at the time in the Hill versus Colorado case said, in addition to the fact that they found that it was content neutral, they also said, you know, there's this real government interest that's at stake here, and that's ensuring access, free access to healthcare facilities, right, and ensuring that people can access them without feeling intimidated, and that's not related to the content of the speech that the protester may be trying to communicate.
Okay. So you think now they're going to reverse Hill?
I think they're going to reverse Hill. And
what's the name of the new case?
Well, the name of the new case is McCullen versus Coakley. McCullen versus Coakley. And the reason that I think that they are going to reverse Hill is twofold. I think first, Hill was a little bit of a surprise as far as the way it came out. And one reason is because the Supreme Court, for the past 50 years, if not longer, has said that sidewalks and parks and public spaces are the quintessential area within our kind of community that people are allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights.
Traditional public fora.
And so the Supreme Court is always very vigilant about protecting a speaker's right to access those fora and to be able to exercise their First Amendment rights within those fora.
Sure.
And so I think that's one reason that Hill maybe was a little surprising when it was handed down. And so that's one reason I think Hill is potentially going to be overruled. And the other is a little less maybe theoretical and a little bit more practical. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think that this McCullen versus Coakley case is going to end up overruling the Hill versus Colorado case is because when Hill versus Colorado was decided.
When was that again?
That was in the late 90s or mid-90s maybe.
Okay.
And here are the judges that decided Hill versus Colorado. It was Justice Stevens, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Mm-hmm. Those were the justices that voted in favor of finding that the statute in Colorado was permissible.
You just named a bunch of dead people.
They are all dead.
Or gone.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the justices that voted against or were in the dissent in the Hill versus Colorado were Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy.
Oh, boy.
And they are still...
Those guys just keep hanging on.
They are still on the court, and I think that it's very likely that in addition to those three dissents, you'll also get Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. And so... I think
that's a pretty good prediction, and because this court has also been very, very speech protective.
Very speech protective, and in particular, the McCullen versus Coakley case, which comes out of Massachusetts, unlike Hill versus Colorado, which was all healthcare facilities, the Massachusetts statute controlled speech within 35 kind of bubble zone in front of specifically abortion clinics.
Okay, so this is a different statute.
So it's slightly different.
But they might use it to effectively or even maybe specifically overrule Hill versus Colorado.
That's right.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in a year.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Doug McKechnie.
You're welcome.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking today with my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law in our annual roundup of important and interesting cases from the United States Supreme Court, because, you know, the Supreme Court's term starts in October of every year. After the break, we'd have our quiz, but I've actually got a special treat for you right after the break, and then we'll continue on and talk to some others of my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law. Stick around. Before the break, we were talking with my buddy Doug McKechnie, who always comes on, and I tease him that every time he comes on, we have to talk dirty. And in fact, the last time he was on the show, we did an episode on Breast Cancer Awareness Month and the controversy over the warning here, I'm going to mention a vulgar term again, the controversy over the so-called I Love Boobies bracelets that some students at public schools were being disciplined for wearing to school and the First Amendment issues surrounding that. Recently, we received a reaction about that episode from one of our listeners in North Carolina. Her name is Karen Plyler, and she had a lot to say.
Hey, I was calling just to comment about the pink day thing. Oh, my goodness. See, I was a public school educator, and I always wondered about why there was such a big emphasis on pink day. Because, you know, why don't we talk about, you know, everybody's worried about, you know, the boobies thing, well, okay, why don't we talk about nuts, you know, the men's thing, and have, you know, why? I think it just all needs to be taken out of public schools, no matter if it's pink or gray or blue or purple or whatever it is. You know, there should be no big deal about it in school. And I know when I was a public school educator, pink day kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and North Carolina when I was a teacher, you know, so, but, oh, it's pink day, you know. Okay, so we're talking about women's breasts, but what about men's balls, you know, or nuts, or, you know, I mean, so, okay, now they're doing the booby thing, so, and I just don't, I think it's all inappropriate, and it's just inappropriate, and I think it all ought to be taken out of the schools and not be, they should not use the schools to, you know, get the money or whatever they need for the, you know, big breast cancer research, okay, whatever. So, okay, you know, how about men's testicular cancer? You know, let's talk about that. You know, I just don't, I think it's all inappropriate. It's just all inappropriate. And my number, and I will be glad to talk on any public radio station about this, but my number is, and I'm in North Carolina, and I worked in Cleveland County Schools for 26 years and all that. So, but I, it's 704-418-SKIP. And I just get really upset when I hear about the pink day thing because, you know, our kids in the band, I was a band director, and our kids, it was a pink day, you know. They did pink everything, pink this and pink that. And why are we doing this? Oh, because it's pink day, you know. I'm like, I don't care. I really thought it was too over talked about. You know, we're talking about a women's mammary gland, you know. So I'm sure the men feel very left out of this situation. You know, let's have a nuts day, you know, and talk about the nuts, you know, and the different sizes of the, you know, let's not call them nuts, let's call them, you know, I don't know. And the kids should not be allowed to wear booby bracelets. Sorry, but they shouldn't. Just like they couldn't wear Budweiser shirts, you know, to school. They cannot wear booby bracelets. So, you know, it's just all that. And this thing about somebody going to court about it is just stupid. So, okay, call me back. I'll be glad to talk. Thanks. All right, bye-bye. And my name is Karen Plyler, P-L-Y-L-E-R. Thank you. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Karen. We appreciate your comments very much. And that reminds me, we appreciate hearing from our listeners all the time. And if you'd like to leave a message for us, please call us here at WETS. The number is 888-895-WETS. That's 888-895-9387. If you'd like to leave a message, please do so. Or if you prefer email, our email address is ywc@montpelier.org. That's again, ywc@montpelier.org. And you spell Montpelier, MONTPELIER. And in either case, please do indicate your name and how we can contact you and whether you mind if we read or play your comments on the air. We'd like to do that. We love to hear from you, whether you agree with us or not, whether you love us, whether you hate us, please let us know. And now it's time to return to our annual roundup of the 2013 Supreme Court docket. And next on our list is Danielle Kaiser of the Appalachian School of Law, who's going to tell us all about collective bargaining and labor law.
Labor law is one of my interests, and this case is Mulhall versus Unite here, Local 355.
Okay, Mulhall, M-U-L?
H-A-L-L.
Okay.
Yes, the gentleman's name is Martin Mulhall.
So what's his problem?
Well, Mr. Mulhall is employed by a company called Mardi Gras Gaming, and they're a company that's in Florida. They run dog tracks.
Oh,
and
cool.
Betting parlors.
I've been to the dog track.
Yeah. If you're interested in those things, you go to Mardi Gras Gaming.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Mulhall had been an employee of Mardi Gras for some time when Unite Here, which is one of the largest hospitality and service workers unions in the country, approached the employer, Mardi Gras, and said that they would like to unionize the workforce. Mr. Mulhall opposed unionization. And so when Mardi Gras and Unite Here entered into a neutrality agreement, which basically said that the employer, Mardi Gras, would give certain assistance to the union in unionizing its employees in exchange for concessions from the union.
It's sort of like a pre-collective bargaining agreement between a union that wants to unionize and an employer who probably is not thrilled about it. It's sort of like, what, they're just establishing ground rules for the unionization?
That is exactly
effort.
Right.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's
neutrality
cool.
Neutrality agreements tend to establish ground rules for the union's campaign.
Okay.
Usually they go along with a card check vote, so mm-hmm. if the union can get enough cards collected from employees where they have checked the box saying that they want the union to come in, then the employer will accept that as the decision of the employees, and they won't require the NLRB to come in and run a secret ballot election.
The National Labor Relations Board.
Yes.
Right, okay, so this is a relatively informal way of going about it as opposed to involving the feds.
Yes.
Okay.
You can do a neutrality agreement, and the National Labor Relations Board does not have to be involved in the election, although they will be overseeing it, but they don't have to run the actual union election. I think these are entered into in cases where the employer recognizes that the union is probably going to win the organizing campaign in the long run. The employer benefits from it because typically the union gives up the right to strike. So the union, in entering a neutrality agreement, agrees that they won't exercise that right to strike against that employer once the collective bargaining agreement is signed.
Really?
Yes.
Well, wait a second. From a union perspective, aren't they giving away the farm before they even organize them?
They are giving away a very powerful legal tool that
yeah.
they have to bargain on behalf of their employees. Yes.
Wow.
But they are also unionizing a workforce. And so both the union and the employer view it as a winning situation for them.
I guess.
Neutrality agreements are very common. It is the most common way for unions to organize a workforce in the modern era. They've been assailed in court on a couple of different grounds, including on the grounds on which Mr. Mulhall attacked this mm-hmm. particular neutrality agreement. The reason is that the law prohibits an employer from giving a union something of value.
Okay, and what did he give them?
Well, the law is aimed at curbing it's aimed at curbing bribery.
Right, yeah.
Right. So employers are not allowed to give union things of value because we don't want employers bribing union officials and attempting
to unduly enforce them. If I'm a business owner, I'm going to want to get very friendly with the leader of the union and
exactly.
take him out to dinner and on vacations, and then we will never have any problems.
Well, savvy employers know that you can't give things of value to the union mm-hmm. or to its representatives.
Okay.
So that establishes a fair amount of distance between the union and the employer. So, Mr. Mulhall argued that this neutrality agreement that Mardi Gras entered into with Unite Here represented a thing of value. The organizing assistance that the employer is offering to the union is a thing of value in Mr. Mulhall's view, and the 11th Circuit agreed with him.
What is it? And let me make sure I'm clear on this. Now, Mulhall, again, is who? Is he?
He's the employee.
He's the employee, and he says that this neutrality agreement represented essentially a bribe by the company to the union.
Bribe is too strong a word, because remember, the statute doesn't say bribe. It just
says thing
that
of value.
The employer can't deliver, pay, or lend a thing of value to the union.
That's interesting. I wonder why he's doing that. I mean, does he think that this is just a bad deal he doesn't want the union to enter into, or what?
I suspect that Mr. Mulhall is just anti-union in general.
Oh, he's just an anti-union employee?
He's an anti-union employee.
Oh, okay.
I suspect that because he's represented by the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation.
That's a good supposition.
Which is a
Now we see what's going on here.
It's a prominent, I don't want to say that they're a prominent anti-union organization,
yeah,
but that is their primary primary
probably
goal.
Fair. Okay.
You know, Mr. Mulhall is in a right-to-work state, and mm-hmm. he believes that this is he doesn't need to be unionized, and so it's his right to try to avoid unionization if he can. He came up with a legal argument that the 11th Circuit agreed with. And so the 11th Circuit...
11th Circuit's in Atlanta. Okay,
yes.
So it's Southern. It's typically one of the more conservative
right.
ones.
Right, and
okay.
this case is coming out of Florida.
Okay.
And so the 11th Circuit agreed that Mr. Mulhall might be able to show that the employer had delivered a thing of value, or actually, I'm sorry, had paid a thing of value to the union.
Wow. And so the Supreme Court took this case?
The Supreme Court has granted cert. Now, mind you, Mr. Mulhall has yet to have his day in court. There's been no trial because this, as many cases that get before the Supreme Court do, it's been through motions to dismiss.
Oh, they tried to dismiss it. Yeah,
yes,
it went all the way up here. So basically, we're just getting to the point where can we even have a trial
right,
on this
right.
issue?
So basically, the 11th Circuit is saying that they think Mr. Mulhall may be able to state a claim. Under the law that the employer has delivered a thing of value to the union.
Okay. Is the 11th Circuit the only one that's opined on this point, or is
it
there a split?
It is not. There is a split. The Third Circuit has actually looked at this, and they found that organizing assistance like this could be a thing of value, but they did not see how this organizing assistance could be delivered to the union. Because remember, there's two things you have to satisfy here. You have to show that there's a thing of value, and you have to show that there's been a payment, a loan, or a delivery of the thing of value to the union.
And this is more intangible.
Right. They're saying that it's an intangible item and that it can't really be delivered,
and
paid,
the Third
or
Circuit,
lent.
Not to be too cynical, is from Philadelphia. And it's from up north, and there's much more sympathy for unions up north than in the south.
Well, you might think that, but interestingly enough, the Fourth Circuit, which has never been known as a union-sympathetic circuit...
In Richmond.
Right. In Richmond, you know, which hears cases from Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina... On this same issue, the Fourth Circuit held that this organizing assistant, this kind of organizing assistance, couldn't be a thing of value.
Oh, okay.
That it was not the sort of thing. The Fourth Circuit really looked at the fact that the statute criminalizes the payment of money or things of value. And they said that's what the statute is looking for, is real payments.
Wow, very interesting. Okay, well, what's your prediction, Danielle?
Well, honestly, my prediction is that the U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to come up with the same result as the 11th Circuit. The reason is this. I don't think this is a pro-labor Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court finds that a neutrality agreement like this does violate criminal law, is actually equivalent to a bribe, it cripples the ability of unions to organize workforces going forward.
Yep.
And I wouldn't be so surprised if the Supreme Court took their opportunity to do that.
It's an extremely pro-business Supreme Court.
It is.
If there's any stamp of the Roberts Court, which began when Chief Justice Roberts took office in 2005, it's that they've been taking lots more business cases, and business has been getting, they've been having a really good ride. And
yes,
so
have.
You're thinking maybe this will be another part of that.
I think this may be another part of that, and I think that the Supreme Court may take this opportunity to deal a blow to organized labor. Now, do I think they'll follow the reasoning of the 11th Circuit? I don't, because frankly, I find the reasoning of the 11th Circuit very difficult to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they reached the right result.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Supreme Court, just having this issue before them lets them come up with whatever reasoning
they want. That's right. They're very good at that. Very
yes,
good at that.
Are.
Well, Danielle Kaiser of the Appalachian School of Law, thanks very much. And we'll come back in next year and see what happened.
Thank you.
Thanks to Danielle Kaiser for that fascinating discussion of labor law in front of the United States Supreme Court. In just a minute, we'll be hearing from Pat Baker and Buzz Belleville all about the environment and natural resources. But first, let's have our Madison Minute.
James Madison created a proposal for a new national government, which became known as the Virginia Plan. Most people are familiar with its key elements, including a powerful central government that could create uniform laws, proportional representation in Congress, and a system of checks and balances between three distinct branches of the national government. One provision, however, is less familiar to modern Americans. Madison thought the national government should have authority to veto state laws in order to prevent the states from evading national laws, violating treaties, and harassing other states. Madison described the role of the national government as that of an umpire to mediate disputes and quell factions. Indeed, Madison thought that the federal judiciary should have the same supremacy over state courts, and there should even be some degree of central control over state militias. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
Now let's see what's happening this week at Montpelier. Sean O'Brien, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm getting ready for a big event at Montpelier.
A big event. What is happening at Montpelier?
This is our one of our biggest events of the year. It is the Montpelier Hunt Races, which is a series of steeplechase races right out in front of the mansion.
Okay, now before we get to the details, why in the world would James Madison's Montpelier have horse races? I mean, was he a big horse guy? Is that where this comes from?
Well, Madison was a big horse guy and was actually quite an impressive horseman and rode great distances. He would ride to Monticello to visit Thomas Jefferson and vice versa. In fact, that distance today we traverse in maybe 45 minutes, even in an electric car.
Right.
On a horse, it might actually require an overnight in Gordonsville because
really?
It was just too far to do it in a single day, unless you were really dedicated to getting there.
So James Madison was a horse guy.
So he was a horse guy, but the reason we do horse races is because Montpelier was owned by the DuPont family from 1901 to 1983.
Right.
And Marion DuPont Scott was very interested in thoroughbred horses, Battleship being one of the most famous horses that she owned. And so we are going to be hosting the 79th running of the annual steeplechase race.
This is an extremely cool event. Now, I can't claim to have seen it. I haven't seen it yet, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be there this year. I'm going to see it eventually, but I can tell you that when you drive into the front of Montpelier, that's one of the first things you see is all those the fences, and then, of course, the course.
Right.
And then when you're getting ready for the steeplechase, all the obstacles and everything.
Right. We actually still have boxwood jumps, which is very unusual. The sanctioned races use artificial jumps because it's a little safer for the horses, but we usually do one race over the old boxwoods for old time's sake, and it's kind of more exciting to see them crash through the feet sort of right. crash through the tops of the bushes. And,
now, just for the uninitiated, the boxwoods, of course, are the shrubs. I mean, what right. people use for shrubs, and they're very common in this area, and you can actually trim them and make them look boxy. I guess that's where the name comes from,
Probably.
I'm guessing. They have an interesting scent as well. Boxwoods are very interesting. Yep. But you're telling me this is the tradition then in steeplechase.
Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. In the, you know, British Grand National, they jumped over hedges that were, you know, 8 feet tall. I mean, these amazing feats of athleticism from these horses and from these riders.
Right.
We do it a little bit more safely than they did in the old days. Because we don't want to hurt anybody or hurt any of the animals. But we're anticipating somewhere around 15,000 people.
Wow.
It's the first Saturday in November every year.
Right.
You know, cross your fingers. The forecast, it's a little too early to say what it's going to be next week. But, you know, typically that first weekend in November, we're having one of those late warm spells.
That would be nice.
It's been as warm as 80 degrees for the races.
But you know
what?
I bet this is kind of like football. I mean, yeah, most people want to go there and they want the nice weather, but the real fans want thunder and lightning and a deluge of rain so that you can really see what the horses
Maybe
can
on the
do.
Gridiron you want that, but we don't want thunder and lightning. We'd be happy if it had rained a few days before, so it's nice conditions, but not muddy.
Okay.
Cool weather is much better for the horses. They're much happier in that because they're really working very, very hard. So, you know, temperatures in the 40s and 50s will be fantastic. We've done the races in the snow. We've done the races in the rain. It's fun no matter what.
So this happens no matter what the weather is?
So far.
Okay. So come on out, even if it is rainy, but we're, of course, hoping for a nice, crisp autumn day.
So if you go to MontpelierRaces.org on the web.
MontpelierRaces.org. That's one word.
One word. Montpelier Races. So there's two R's in the middle. .org. You can buy tickets online. I would advise buying tickets in advance. Because you're probably not going to get them at the gate.
Really? It's going to be filled up?
Very, very likely.
Yeah. Wow, that is something important. Okay, MontpelierRaces.org. Get your tickets in advance and
very fun
show up.
Tailgate parties. It's a great time.
Sounds like a good time. I'm going to try to make it myself. All right. Thanks, Sean O'Brien.
See you there.
And now let's continue our Roundup 2013 version of the important and interesting cases pending at the United States Supreme Court. Next, we'll speak to Professor Pat Baker of the Appalachian School of Law.
We're going to talk about the cross-state air pollution rule.
Cross-state air pollution rule.
Yeah, which is, the acronym is CASPER.
CASPER, like Casper the Friendly Ghost who floats around in the air.
I'm not sure that's what the EPA had in mind. I actually think that they were probably thinking about nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide.
Ah, you're probably right.
Acid rain.
Yeah.
Although Casper's been known to be a menace.
So I guess there's some rule out there that regulates what one state can send across to another state.
That's right. The EPA under the Clean Air Act promulgated the cross-state air pollution rule to try to limit these pollutants in the atmosphere. And they really target 28 states, and those 28 states are primarily, they have a high percentage of coal-fired utility power plants. Mm-hmm. And a byproduct of a coal-fired power plant is nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide, which cause acid rain.
Mm-hmm.
And
that does create a problem. Both, I mean, let's say I'm the state of Tennessee, and let's say I have a number of coal-fired plants, which I think they do for the TVA, and I burn the coal and I put the stuff in the air. Well, it doesn't stay in Tennessee. It then starts typically heading toward the east,
right,
given the way the jet stream flows. And so somebody maybe in Delaware who doesn't have a lot of coal-fired plants, nonetheless, gets the bad result.
Right.
And the acid rain and all that stuff.
That's correct. And so, you know, the rule, the states and the utilities have a problem. The real problem with the rule is it doesn't adequately address the upwind states' pollution that trickles down to the downwind states.
So the downwind states are the ones who are complaining about
this. Right, the downwind states are held to the same standard as the upwind states.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're claiming that, you know, the data and the direction that's provided by the EPA is not clear enough so that they can implement a plan to limit these pollutants because it's not taking into account the pollutants that are coming from across state lines.
Oh, okay. So if I'm already, let's say I'm Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already getting a load, if you will, from Tennessee.
Right.
And now, effectively, I'm adding to whatever came to Tennessee, but I'm going to get penalized not just for my own pollution,
right,
but what came from Tennessee.
Right. And then Maryland is going to be penalized for Virginia and Tennessee. And so you see this escalation of pollution.
Right.
And so what the states, you know, the attorney generals in the states and then the utilities are claiming is that you have to factor in the amount of these pollutants that are in each state that, you know, have come across state lines, that has to be...
That didn't originate there.
Right.
I would think they would do that anyway. I guess what, they're measuring ambient air concentrations of these currently.
Right.
I would think they would have been measuring emissions all along. If you measure emissions, then each state's only going to be penalized for whatever emissions it has.
Right.
Is that what they're asking for? Is it more of an emissions-based rule rather than an ambient air measurement rule?
I think the issue with the case is I think the EPA has not allowed the states enough time to implement their own plan into dealing, to deal with the emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the states are asking, you know, one of the issues in the case is the states were asking for more time and that they weren't, you know, that they weren't provided enough time to try to implement their own plan to curb the emissions. And it's really an agency deference issue in the sense that, you know, when you get in these Clean Water and Clean Air Act cases, courts don't like to get into the science and the data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why Congress created the agency and gave them, you know, the power. And so courts tend to give agencies great deference.
Mm-hmm.
And so courts tend to avoid getting into the science behind it and instead to defer to the agency. But, you know, the rule was struck down, at the district court level and the Court of Appeals.
Oh, really? So, the EPA's rule has been struck down?
Right.
So the courts have been siding with these states?
They have. And so the original CASPER rule, which was put in place during the Bush administration in 2008, is still the rule that's in place.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the case gets struck down by the court, what you'll likely see is the EPA promulgate another rule.
Mm-hmm.
And then see if they can regulate air quality a little differently.
Yeah, the constitutional issue here is kind of hidden beneath all the science and beneath all this pollution talk, and that is, as you said, that, you know, Congress is the body in our Constitution that's supposed to make laws.
Mm-hmm.
But we have such a highly technical society now. Congress doesn't feel maybe competent or inclined to do this, so they create an agency and they say, agency, you take care of it. And they'll even let the agency make rules, and these rules will have the force and effect of law.
Right.
So if, you know, they've delegated that responsibility, then if someone challenges that rule and it goes to court, the question ultimately, as you say, comes down to, well, do we really want to second guess the EPA or not? I mean, they're supposedly the experts. So it's really how much deference we give them. And this far, it looks like, twice the EPA hasn't gotten a lot of deference.
Right. That's exactly right.
I wonder why that is. I mean, is this rule really that off the wall? Or did you think the courts just want to give the states more time or what?
I think the courts want to give the states more time, but I think there is a fundamental fairness issue in the sense that I think the states and utilities have made a strong case that the way that the air quality is calculated and in the way that the emissions are calculated doesn't fairly address the amount of pollution that is caused by the upwind states and the downwind states.
Fairness is an issue that goes straight to the concept of due process. So apparently the lawyers for the utilities in the states have done a good job of basically saying this ain't fair.
Right.
Interesting. Well, we'll be very interested to see how the Supreme – any predictions how the Supreme Court will go?
You know, I really don't. I mean, as you know, I mean, there's only been a handful of Clean Air or Clean Water Act cases that have made it to the Supreme Court. I mean, mm-hmm. the courts have generally stayed out of the science and the, right. and the technical aspects of this.
But have they granted cert in this case?
They have, yeah. It'll okay, be heard so this term.
Wow. Well, then, I mean, obviously four justices at least think it's important enough.
Well, and I think the other thing is I think it'll have implications on today, which what's interesting today, actually, that we do this interview, is that the Wall Street, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, EPA promulgated their new greenhouse gas rule.
It just came out?
This came out today.
Oh, I wonder if that'll get challenged.
Well, and I don't think there's any doubt, but it'll be interesting to see what the court does with this, and I think it'll be a good kind of precursor to what, you know, potentially you could expect.
Well, what's interesting to me is that the industry has won below.
Right.
And if the Supreme Court grants cert, that indicates there's at least a chance they're going to reverse the industry.
Right. That's exactly right.
That sounds kind of environmentalist to right. me. And that's not necessarily consistent with most people's impression of the court these days.
Right.
It's being relatively conservative. So this is really intriguing. I wonder what's going on up there.
I think it'll probably all come down to Justice Kennedy.
The perennial prediction of modern Supreme Court watchers. It'll all come down to Justice Kennedy. Yeah.
I mean, all the arguments will be tailored to Kennedy.
Yes, they will.
So one, I'm not sure our forefathers intended one person to make all the instruments.
On an evenly divided court, yeah. it's that one vote. Yeah. Well, so. Pat Baker, thanks very much for sharing that with us, and we'll look forward to finding out what happens.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you, and thanks, and I think the show's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Well, you know, Pat Baker was right. He's been proven right already, because shortly after I spoke to Pat, the EPA came out with its new greenhouse gas regulation, and by golly, it was challenged instantaneously, and it's already made its way all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and lots of important issues are there. Now, in just a moment, we'll talk to Buzz Belleville, who was my environmental guy at the Appalachian School of Law. But I have to admit to you, I have to apologize. There's a bit of a technical issue. I used a microphone for the first time that didn't work as well as I wanted it to, so you're going to notice a little bit of difficulty hearing my voice. I apologize for that. It won't happen again. And also, we don't have a lot of time left, so let me summarize the first part of my discussion with Buzz. Buzz explained to me that you have to understand the starting point is a case called EPA versus Massachusetts, in which the Supreme Court decided some very important issues of standing and other obscure constitutional doctrine. But it eventually said, you know, okay, this greenhouse gas situation is serious. It is caused by human activity, and the EPA does have the power to regulate it, at least as far as tailpipe emissions from cars. Now, that's important because what is the significance of that? Does it mean that EPA also can regulate other CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions from other sources like smokestacks at factories? Or does it mean that it can't or that it must do that? Or does it mean that it can't do that? So can't or must are the three things that the Supreme Court is currently going to decide in this very important issue of statutory interpretation. Now let's join Buzz as he tells us what he thinks is going to happen at the High Court. When we join the interview, Buzz is reacting to my suggestion that maybe the issue here is that back in 1970, when this act was drafted, people really didn't understand the imminent danger of greenhouse gases.
I think that's fair, and I think that's especially fair for the opponents in Mass v. EPA in 2007. They were definitely making that argument. I think the counterargument that carried the day in Mass v. EPA, at least with the 5-4 majority, was that the act was intentionally written quite broadly with a very broad definition of air pollutant, recognizing that science changes and our knowledge changes, and EPA is going to continually look for dangerous stuff in the air and ratchet down the parts per million allowed and that sort of thing. So there's a counter argument, but I think you're in essence, your position is absolutely right. And I think it's a fair argument.
Well, it's not so much my position. I'm just trying to figure out what the opponents of the EPA are arguing. So there is actually an issue here. It goes to the original intent of the people who drafted this act 43 years ago. And it's going to be a question of whether the court reads the act narrowly or broadly.
Yeah, and I think the trick, what's going to be hard for the Roberts and the Thomases of the world is they generally apply rules of statutory interpretation of the plain language, and they would be loath to interpret the word any pollutant in one section of the Act to mean something different than any pollutant, quote-unquote, in another section of the Act. So I think that's going to be tough for them.
Any pollutant's a pretty broad category.
It is. It is. And then certainly there's but that's it. That's specifically what the opponents are saying here, is that pollutant in Title I does not mean the same thing as pollutant in Title II.
Guess we'll just have to see predictions.
I think that this is a tough one for industry to overcome. But four justices wanted to grant cert, so I think that there is and there's differing opinions on the scope of the question that they're going to address. It's possible, you know, the more devastating one to greenhouse gas regulation would have been if the Supreme Court took up the endangerment finding, for instance, questioning whether there's scientific basis for concluding that greenhouse gases are dangerous. They didn't take that up. They didn't take up the tailoring rule or the tailpipe rule, per se. Instead, they just said they're just taking up a very limited issue, and they could say that you don't have to issue national ambient air quality standards for carbon dioxide, but everything else you're doing, the new source performance standards, is all fine. Or they could say, you can't do anything with stationary, or you're not required to do anything with stationary sources. Or they could say you're not allowed to do anything with stationary sources. So there's really, even though it seems like a very limited question, there's three ways they can go that will have a huge difference. So I do think that a narrow ruling on national ambient air qualities, and the EPA is not required to do this, is a possibility. But the underlying legal basis for regulating greenhouse gases, I can't see getting tossed out here.
Well, then let's just see what happens. And thank you, Buzz Bell, for bringing us up to date in this very, very important statutory interpretation case.
You're very welcome. I must point out one more thing before you let me go, because last year's Roundup show, you rode me pretty good for being wrong in my prediction from 2 years ago.
Right.
And last year I dealt with a torture case in Nigeria involving the Shell Oil Company, uh-huh. And I suggested that the Supreme Court would rule that United States courts did not have jurisdiction, and I was accurate last year.
We're accurate on that one. I'm sorry I didn't ask you, Buzz. I should have asked you. I'm going to give you your props now. Congratulations. You accurately predicted that. So I think you're up to 50% now, right?
I am. We'll go for 67%, and I will say a very limited ruling that EPA doesn't have to issue and national ambient air quality standards. But beyond that, I think they'll be allowed to go forward with their new source performance standards.
So they don't have to, but they can.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll come back in a year and we'll see how you did.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Buzz.
Take care.
And that's our roundup for October 2013 of all the important and interesting cases pending now. Well, not all of them, but several of the most important and interesting cases pending in front of the United States Supreme Court, courtesy of all of my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law. Thanks so very much to Marianne and to, Marianne Herman, that's her full name, to Doug McKechnie, to Danielle Kaiser, to Pat Baker, and to Buzz Belville for telling us about all those interesting cases. And, of course, also to our distribution engineers, Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, although she didn't have to do much scheduling this time because all these people were down the hall from me. If you're listening on the radio, then we've got a podcast and you can find us on the internet. So Google us and download us. You can use iTunes if you want to. And if you're listening to a podcast, we're also a radio show. And if we're not on your local public radio station, give them a call and tell them you want your weekly constitutional on their schedule. Thanks also to the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps for our marvelous opening and closing music. And thanks also to Karen Plyler of North Carolina. Remember, she's the listener who called in. If you want to call in, make sure and call us at WETS at 888-895-WETS. That's 888-895-9387. Or email us at ywc@montpelier.org and let us know what you think of the show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.